emotions. That is, and Hegel already said this, there is no example. One usually, God cannot be an example. Thinks the name of God is not a name among others. It must function differently. Hegel already said this. And to come to your distinction, to the distinction between mention and use, is not to say whether you are mentioning this name or using it, and you add often not true when you are doing the one or the other.
I'm not sure either, because if there is something unique in the name of God, it names, and in the way we name in the name of God through it, there is something unique. That is, the distinction between mentioning and using is not pertinent anymore. If you want this distinction to work, you have to at least imply that when you use a word, there is a reference. Say, give me a glass. Okay?
Goeiedag. U luistert naar Trent Radio 92.7 FM in Peterborough.
All right, boys and girls, this is Web Madman, a.k.a. Wayne Elliott, back at you for another week of Art Space, Noise Space, and I'm just getting myself set up here so that I can make some noise and do some talking and all of that fun stuff with you all. This week, I thought one of the things that I'd like to touch on is my friend Tammy Lynn Foreman of Original Plastic, as I'm typing it in, .com, has been doing instant video. Now, of course, I'll be just playing the audio here on the air. Her latest is her track called Overwhelmed. And it is musical, but as per usual, Tammy tends to push the edges a little bit, which is part of the reason why I'm a big, big fan. So without further ado, I will play you some Tammy Lynn Foreman, her song Overwhelmed, on the website Original Plastic. .com.
What did I come in here for? What did
So that was first one was Tammy Lynn Forman doing her song Overwhelmed, and then followed up by yours truly, Web Madman, doing my own cover of the Overwhelmed there.
I saw the video for Tammy's.
Yeah.
Was that done live?
Yes. Yeah, these instant videos are actually done live. Now, they rehearse them a number of times to get,
sure,
you know, the right shot, but they're, what you see is the take.
And she's operating the delays herself?
Oh, yeah, yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. No, she's got one of those
really
groovy super loopers.
Is that what it's called?
Something like that. Yeah, super looper, I think, is, yep.
Yeah.
And it can, you know, do lots of crazy sampling, looping, nuts kind of stuff. One of the things I was going to mention is I was talking to Tammy just after she had finished doing that, and we were talking about how we were having conversations back in the early 90s about what we wanted to do as artists and performers. And our conclusion is that we want to make people feel stuff. Actually, stuff isn't the word we used, but we're on the air, so
right.
I'll keep it somewhat PG. So yeah, that was kind of what our sense of intention, and it's kind of cool because we've kind of followed through with that.
Yeah.
She's developed more and more of an experimental edge. The stuff that she does.
I can tell.
Yeah. She started out, actually, her dad was is actually quite a well-known country and western bluegrass kind of fiddle player guy up north. And so she grew up doing festivals with him, going across Canada, doing folk festivals.
So she was exposed to a lot of really good music.
That's right, yeah. And starting at a really young age, would get on stage with her dad and do various songs. Particularly Angel of Montgomery was one of the perennial favorites.
Yeah.
When I first met her, she was still doing, you know, sort of more traditional folk style of music, you know, playing guitar, doing very kind of structured songs. Then it kind of careened off into some very interesting spaces.
She should come jam with Full Metal Booty sometime.
Well, yeah, she's kind of been on the peripheral a couple of times,
right,
when we've had Lester come out and do projections. Her partner Lester is a filmmaker and projection artist. Which reminds me, I should mention that we haven't got a day scheduled yet, but we are going to be doing a sort of more open house Full Metal Booty at some point coming up. Hopefully over the next month, I think that we're kind of... And we'll do one of those kind of multimedia extravaganzas.
Yeah. Any dancers who,
yep,
want to dance through projections?
Yep.
Slide and video projections?
Yep.
Would be welcome.
Yep. Come out and make some movement, some noise, you know, pitch in. Because that's the other thing where myself, my current mandate, and especially with Full Metal Booty, is art as a collaborative process, as something that, you know, you kind of try to engage in some sort of creative dialogue with other people with.
Yeah, we used to have... dancers from the Downey Street Collective show up almost regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that was great. I had a bunch of bed sheets that they could play with.
That's right.
So I had my projectors.
Yeah.
Slide projectors and my homemade slides and whatever weirdness I'd gathered up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the liquid lighting.
Yep.
Which is very messy.
Yep. And complicated to set up. And
yeah. But no, it was great.
Yeah.
The dancers weaving in and out of the light,
mm-hmm,
and providing their own screens.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's and again, you know, like it's just kind of creating a space where there's not a lot of simply spectating, but rather people feel kind of inspired to jump up and do stuff.
Yeah.
And
I think with a big, like an official concert.
Yep.
Instead of sneaking in the back door kind of thing.
Yep.
yeah, we'll get a higher profile.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll promote ourselves. We'll promote the show.
Yep.
We'll probably sell beer.
Yep. Yes, it'll be licensed.
That won't be my responsibility personally.
Nope. That'll be Art Space.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that the times that we've had a lot of people show up tend to be when there's projections going on, and especially when we're doing it in the front space, because people...
Well, that attracts attention.
That's right. People walking by go, whoa, what's going on there? So we'll be sure to keep you up to date here on Art Space Noise Space from 4 to 5 every Friday. And as we know specifics, we will let you know of those specifics. Meanwhile, what should we talk about this week?
I have no idea.
No idea. Well, one of the things to come back to what I was mentioning with Tammy is the idea of getting people to feel stuff. And we've talked before about, particularly there was one guy that came to Full Metal Booty for a while, and you were talking to him, the guy that was schizophrenic, who found what we did very healing. I think that that's something that I would definitely like to reach towards in terms of kind of looking at the space for music or sound within a tribal environment where, you know, you go into trance state, you experience kind of altered state of consciousness.
Well, you know, that happens to us when we're really intense.
That's right.
We do an hour-long jam or longer.
Yep.
And have no idea that we've been playing that long.
That's right, yes. And I think that that's the sort of thing where, you know, and I think that there's different... methodologies that can allow you to reach that space. And I think with Full Metal Booty, I think the key to it is, like you say, intensity. I think that that's probably the best word to describe what we're doing. And it just seems like it snowballs. Because I find that the most intense jams that we do tend to start out very ambient and slow.
But that gives us allows us to listen to each other very closely.
Yeah,
which is why it does build up to something so intense.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, again, that sort of key of like everyone that's participating is actually listening to what other people are doing and responding, and you get this amazing kind of conversation going on. Which, as I've said before, what I feel part of what we're reaching for is to find the same spaces that you find within traditional music, but without the structures that traditional music has, which is tricky at best.
But about the music being healing and mind altering, that's definitely something that we should explore more.
Yeah.
And, well, it's going to be easier to do that now that we no longer drink at the jams.
That's right. Yep. So that we're a little less hazy, a little more focused. Takes a little bit more effort, but tends to be worth it once you get there.
Sure. We started out calling ourselves a noise band.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought as we became more sophisticated... Mm-hmm. And listened and interacted more, that we were more than just a noise band, we were a sound band.
Right.
But I think a good way to describe our music would be metabolic music.
Right. Yes.
That's actually the term that was one of the terms being tossed around when Throbbing Gristle were trying to describe their music.
Oh, yeah.
They eventually settled on industrial music.
Right.
They got the slogan from Monte Cazzazza.
Oh, yeah.
Industrial music for industrial people.
Well, because their Throbbing Gristle are definitely an example of where they very consciously tried to create sounds that would physically affect people. You know, the infamous brown note as being one, but there's also just, I think that they were using binaural beats, where you offset frequencies and you get these beat frequencies in between, and that has this kind of effect on consciousness. I've seen concert footage of Throbbing Gristle from, you know, the late 70s, and it was amazing the trance state of the people, you know, like watching the audience and seeing the enthrall.
Is that the San Francisco one where everyone is just bobbing their head slightly?
Yes. Now, there's once, at one point, there's a guy that's crowd surfing. I mean, this was the other interesting thing, is that they were like full out moshing, you know, like there was slam dancing going on around that time with the punk movement. But in terms of mosh, which has a slightly different kind of, it's much more kind of, it's physical,
yeah.
Sensual. There's something slightly more sensual about a mosh pit than straight out slam dancing. At any rate, one of the things that you will get in a mosh is somebody crowd surfing. And so there was this guy that was up on top of the crowd surfing, and Genesis Peorage reached down, grabbed him by the head, and gave him this huge kiss. At which point the guy completely freaked out, in a good way.
Yeah, that was a good scene.
That was probably a highlight of that guy's experience there. But the sheer sense of ecstaticness was something that really caught my attention there, and seemed really timeless. Like I say, I mean, it didn't feel like something out of the 70s. It felt like something out of the 90s.
Yeah, well, it. I think Throbbing Gristle, well, it doesn't date itself.
No.
Occasionally, it might through the use of their technology.
Yeah.
Because the instruments they used at the time. Well, Chris Carter had actually a cheap Casio keyboard.
Right.
Okay, so some of those sounds, and he composed rhythms on that machine.
Yep. Yeah.
But they also. Well, Carter, again, is an electronics freak.
Yeah.
And he built some instruments for them.
Yeah.
He converted a home computer to do digital sampling.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when...
That just wasn't heard of.
Well, there was a sampler on the market in 1979.
Yeah.
It cost as much as a house.
Right.
It was the Fairlight CMI.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right. It would be a studio.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah, like massive.
You didn't carry the thing around with you.
No, yeah.
To gigs.
But, well, in point of fact, some of that concert footage that I saw, I remember seeing, you know, like these crazy, you know, circuit board electronic heaps.
Yeah. And the stack of cassette decks that Sleazy was playing.
Yeah.
That was also built by Chris Carter, and
right.
That's a whole series of cassette decks with variable speed,
mm-hmm.
controlled by a keyboard.
Wow, that's, you know, innovation, eh?
So tape loops of noise or speech or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that was sampling again.
Yeah. Well, and interesting that's part of what is again timeless about their sound is that a lot of the techniques they were using. Are now very commonplace with their own sort of modern derivatives. But at that point in time, you weren't hearing sounds like that by any stretch of the imagination.
Well,
I mean, there was Tangerine Dream an example. But even then, there was, I think that they were still really holding on to musicality. In a very sort of more stringent way, mainly to gather kind of a sense of legitimization.
Tangerine Dream is still around.
Oh yeah,
with only one original member, I think.
Yeah,
and they're quite structured now.
Yeah,
almost composed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the 70s and 80s, they were a lot more improv.
There was a lot of improvisation. I'm thinking in particular of albums like Stratosphere and Rubicon, where there was a lot of sound technique going on, but the note sequences and stuff, they were using classical kind of scores again, I think that they were, you know. Also from interviews at the time, they were struggling with trying to legitimize electronic music at the time because, you know, at that point, nobody took it serious.
Right. Well, except for academics.
Except for academics, but in terms of...
You know, how many people actually listen to that kind of music, though?
Yeah, no.
Stockhausen concert with a bunch of uptight looking guys with graph paper and stopwatches.
Yeah.
So they know that they're properly appreciating it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so it's I think that that's one of the things that Throbbing Gristle were kind of, they had a more anarchist kind of sensibility where they weren't looking for legitimization. They were just looking to do what they wanted to do.
Right. Well, they wanted to get their information across to a larger audience.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah.
They were originally a performance art group.
Yeah.
Coombe Transmissions.
Yeah.
Who were infamous for their use of bodily fluids and violence on in the performance area.
Yep. And sort of that theater of cruelty type of approach to things. And even then, they were also very much into challenging gender roles. Because I know that Genesis used to do a lot of cross-dressing, which, I mean, these days, as we've talked about before, he now has actual breasts. and again, you know, like, I think that there was certainly a context to some degree at the time, but they were really trying to push some boundaries and...
It was during the Thatcher years.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that was more getting into the psychic TV stuff.
Right.
Because Throbbing Gristle was the early kind of, as you say, Coombe Transmissions were definitely the very early
at the
stuff.
The beginning of 1970.
Yeah.
And they also used loud electronic music that they and their friends had made up with tape loops and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't meant to be that musical, really.
No, no. And again, like, it was more about trying to have an effect on consciousness, getting people to, you know, feel things, to kind of break them out of their trance by pulling them into a trance.
Right. Well, it was also experimental in the sense that they were trying to figure out how people can be controlled, and then short circuit that.
Yes.
To to reveal the mechanisms of control.
Right. Yes.
And then
bust it open.
Right. Then you're able to defend yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Which dovetails with the Psychic TV project, as much as anything, was built around the Temple of Psychic Youth. Which used a lot of, like, kind of mail art networking in order to, you know, kind of generate a sense of community.
The Coombe Transmission guys were all involved in mail art from the early days.
Yeah. Which I find interesting that to me it's in some ways a precursor to what developed into the BBS and then the internet in terms of trying to grapple hold of the tools for communication and utilizing what tools were available.
Yeah, mail art, we should say a few words about that.
Yeah.
That was, it was a movement in the 70s that, or it became a movement.
Yeah.
Initially it was just a few people sending elaborate packages, letters, postcards to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose people have always done that.
Yeah.
But artists adopted it at late 60s, early 70s, as an alternative to relying on art galleries.
Right.
And so there were various projects. People would collaborate on pieces, send them back and forth, and each person would add more to them.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were finished pieces which they would send around to the people in their network so everyone could get to see it
and,
you know, hang it on their wall for a while if they wanted.
Cool. Because I also know that came out of that was the zine culture, which was, a lot of it was based around fans of punk music. That was, you know, where some of it really pushed into a more a broader consciousness. I know that when I was living at Dragonfly, I came across the ancient zine from the 70s with an interview with Billy Idol was still with Gen X. Really funny reading.
Did you know that Billy Idol's first band called Chelsea opened for the first Throbbing Gristle gig?
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, there was, you know, I think that, you know, within the Throbbing Gristle, there was all of the sensibility that gave birth to the punk movement, but an awareness of consumer culture more so, because I think that was one of the things that led to the kind of co-opting of punk culture, is that it was not as aware as it could have been. To point a fact that some people jumped into it to be exploited.
Sure.
Exploited. And, you know, sort of weren't questioning what that meant and what that actually led to, which was, as a case in point, Billy Idol, where it's like, there's not
sad
anything...
what happened to him.
Yeah, which is, you know, there's no real political awareness going on there. It's just, you know, kind of a packaged rebellion.
yeah.
I don't see Throbbing Gristle being able to be commodified to any degree.
Well, something that's really weird,
yeah,
I found, is that, well, they started out pressing their records at independent pressing plants.
Right.
Where, you know, mm-hmm. Almost like a vanity project, because it
right.
didn't seem like how many people are actually going to buy these things anyway.
Right.
But they ended up going through several editions.
Right.
And from the photocopied covers
oh, yeah.
of the first few to really nice packaging.
Mm-hmm.
As they got more professional, as they
yep.
better understood what they were doing.
Yep.
And they had the advantage of Peter Sleazy
mm-hmm.
Christofferson.
Yep.
being a member of the Hypnosis
yes.
design group.
Yeah, yeah. Which he actually did the cover of Wish You Were Here, interestingly
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, yeah. That's the guy shaking hands with the burning businessman?
That's right.
Yeah.
And then there was a... I don't know whether it was on the back cover or whether it was a postcard insert, but it's this guy sort of poised diving into a pool. Now, apparently, to take... like. Peter, of course, knew a right. yoga master that actually maintained a handstand within a few inches of water long enough for the ripples to stop so
wow.
they could get a picture that
with
looks
reflection.
With the reflection, perfectly still water of this guy looking like he's diving into this pool. Crazy.
That's great.
Yeah, it looks photoshopped, quote unquote.
There was no Photoshop.
There was no, exactly.
They also did the Peter Gabriel, the Melting Face one.
Oh, that totally makes sense.
And I know you probably have never seen this yeah. album cover, the Fabulous Poodles.
No.
Where the people look crumpled.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really weird effect, and that they actually did that. They
right.
they took photos of the people,
yeah.
cut them out of the backgrounds,
yeah.
crumpled them up, smoothed them out a bit,
uh-huh.
and then put them on a background and re-photographed them.
Wow.
But it's a brilliant effect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and again, you know, like, these are all kind of like pre-digital manipulation, but, you know, all of the things that have now become kind of cliched.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were really,
there's a crumpled,
really
there's a crumpled paper effect now in Photoshop. So.
Yeah, no, there's any kind of effect you want.
But that's, you know, kicking it old
almost,
school.
It almost makes it too easy.
Right. Well, and in some ways, I find that when... because I've got my own series of zines and have done, you know, that sort of stuff. And I find that the actual physical process of working with the material... stimulates you in a completely different way, and there's things that emerge from that I feel have more, they're more thought out, as opposed to, you know, I know that there's some people that are real masters with Photoshop and are able to, you know,
right.
create some very interesting stuff, but I think that you have to be really good in order to, you know, push it into
yeah.
something that looks interesting and that is actually, you know, unique.
I really enjoy working with the physical materials of collage. Although it can be really awkward when I have a table covered with clippings and the cat walks over it.
Well, that's a favorite artist of mine is James Cohenline.
Right.
Who does amazing collage work. And he works almost exclusively in Photoshop now. Has for quite a while. Just because he found that it was much cheaper and easier and more convenient.
Yeah, well, just keeping all those images on hand for when you need them.
Yes.
Is an enormous task.
Yeah, I mean, and resizing an image and, you know, like...
Yeah, well, you can't do that with cut and paste.
That's right. Unless you've got a really good color photocopier.
True, but that becomes really expensive.
Yeah.
I've got a filing cabinet that could fit two people comfortably. It's all full of images.
Wow.
So, you know, if I need a fish or a bird or an oil rig or an astronaut...
Right.
I know where to go.
Yeah. No, that's... and then to extend with James Cohenline, he's now actually working a lot with Poser and doing three-dimensional figures and stuff.
Poser? Is that a human...
Yeah.
Wireframe?
Yes. It's part of, I think, it. I may be wrong on this, but I think that it interfaces with 3D Studio Max or... Bryce, something
Bryce
like
3D.
That. One of those, because Poser is just the human, you know, creating a human in order to pose, and then bring it into one of these full featured.
I remember seeing an early version of that.
Yeah. With this, he's doing some very interesting stuff. He's James is quite obsessed with books. His father was a librarian and so had him exposed to and very much into radical literature and cutting edge stuff and avant-garde things. And so James kind of grew up in the world of books, and he's talked about what he's on DeviantArt. He has a very extensive profile on there. And talks about the push-pull of that. How, you know, on one hand, you know, the written word has given him great comfort and given him refuge and, you know, a place to, you know, sort of be. At the same time, it can be very imprisoning and, you know, get you sort of caught in certain tunnels in terms of perception and stuff. And so his latest work is kind of exploring those kinds of themes in some pretty neat ways. Especially because the other thing that, because I've had a few correspondences with him online, and the other thing that kind of stunned me was to find out that he'd actually started out as a graphic illustrator and is incredibly skilled at it.
Yeah.
There's a graphic running around right these days that he did. It's an actual full illustration of a fist made out of pot. and it's legalization thing, and it's beautifully done. So just as a side note, that
I'd like to say that a lot of his earlier collages I've seen ended up as book covers for Atana Media and I don't know, maybe Last Gasp. Some pretty far out underground publishers.
Yeah,
and. The look of them is is almost it's like a religious shrine almost.
Yeah. Yes.
Even though it might be made out of clippings of jungle and buildings and hands or whatever material. A lot of animals and plants.
Yeah.
But there's a sort of a suggestion that it's or a feeling, I guess, that it's like religious art.
Yeah. And in point of fact, he draws from a lot of that kind of iconography. Mentioning that I corresponded with him, where I ran into him online was in a mailing list for the Moorish Orthodox Church.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Not them.
Yes. The MOOC. Mock. which, of course, is also connected with Huck and Bay, aka Peter Lamborn Wilson. That's in terms of book covers. I think James Conline's done almost all of Huckam Bay's covers.
His album cover as well.
Yeah. Yes.
Huckam Bay did Temporary Autonomous Zone,
yep.
Which he read. It was Bill Laswell production.
Yeah. Yes. And that's the other Bill Laswell, a lot of his albums on Axiom Records, which I'm not sure if Axiom is still going. It used to be a subsidiary of Island. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Bill Laswell ended up founding quite a number of record labels.
Yeah.
And I heard that it was partly to escape his tax problems.
Well, and I was going to say, and also the inevitable nastiness of the industry itself. I have my own story of Island Records. Some friends of mine had this band, Mumblin' Jim, and they went to San Francisco, and they were down there for a couple of years, actually, and started to develop quite a good following in that, you know, sort of more traditional sense, and actually got signed to Island Records, and we're going to do an album, and then Island got bought out by yet another major conglomerate. I think there's only two labels anymore.
Sony, and what's the other one?
BMI.
Uh-huh.
Or, no, Universal. Anyway. But it does. It's like it's a huge pyramid now, right? Where it's just like you got, you know, yeah, is that really an independent label?
I had some friends in Toronto who had a band called Maid.
Oh, yeah.
They signed to MCA for $250,000 at the time. Sounds like a fantastic amount of money, but the way that it was doled out to them, they all still had part-time jobs.
Yeah.
So they could feed themselves.
Yeah.
And they shot a great video.
Yeah.
It was actually shot by Louise Lillefeld.
Oh, I know.
You remember her? She brought the Canadian experimental film show to town.
Oh.
She toured all across the country with it.
Right.
Well, she shot the video in the record store owned by one of the members.
Yeah.
Or former members. I think they kicked him out because he spent too much time in his record store. But they turned it into a nightclub for the shoot. And it was a great video, and everyone loved it, and it cost $2,000.
Right.
The record company didn't like it.
Oh.
So they decided they were going to shoot
their own
video. And the money for that, $10,000,
of course,
came out of the band's supposedly their money.
Yeah.
No, the record company can use it whichever
way they want. Yeah. No. And that's I'm trying to remember, there was a TV series in Scotland about a band trying to make it. And that was one of the things that they did all the way through the series was they were showing at the top of the screen the money that they had been given and at the bottom of the screen the money that was being spent. And of course, you know, by the end, you know, it's the money they're getting is in the negative, and
that happens to a bunch of bands.
Yeah.
That due to some creative accounting, they can tour and sell merchandise and sell albums and still end up owing the record company a bunch of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when they're in that position, they do what the record company tells them.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I think that it's you know, in a way, I'm almost like, okay, you know, these guys go for it, you know, because in the end, people are just going to start walking away. In point of fact, you know, two very major bands right now, Nine Inch Nails and Radiohead, as being examples of bands that are quite mainstream that have decided to walk away from labels and do it on their own.
Right. Well, and it's that's working. Very encouraging.
And it's working.
But yes, it's happened with some authors too.
Yeah, Cory Doctorow. Well, no, actually, he's still with a publisher, but he's with a very cool publisher that lets him do release his stuff under the Creative Commons online.
Right. If you want to buy the book,
to
put on your shelf or to hold in your hand, you can do that.
Yeah. But at the same time, you can, if you just want to, you know, read it, you can download it, and it's available and, you know, floating around.
Well, Stephen King did a novel online years and years ago when it was quite a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, just send me some money
Yeah, if you like it.
If I don't get any money, I'm gonna stop writing it.
Right.
And he made more money than he could have through a regular publisher.
Right. Mainly because there's the expenses, right? That go to the, you know, publisher, the printer, the, you know, like all those layers. And this is part of the thing right now that I've been, as you know, very much following the whole copyright issues and how I see so much where they keep trumpeting the, you know, rights of the artist and the, you know, artist being compensated and these sorts of terminologies. But in the end, I don't see the artist actually benefiting. You know, I see that the artist, you know, may have a small token thrown their way. But in the end, it seems like this, you know, the copyright regime in a general sense ends up with the artist coming in last. The artist and the audience, you know, are the ones that are the losers, you know.
Besides the sort of mainstream bands going for the electronic publishing, there are a lot of bands that have always been sort of do-it-yourself.
Yep.
And they're taking advantage of the electronic media to the greatest effect.
Yep.
And they're not even trying to. They're not even sending demos to record labels.
No. They're just
no point.
They're just setting themselves up. Now, one of the things that I've been kind of rattling around in my brain is the idea of in terms of self-publishing and how you can. Release if you're a recording artist, you can release your music online and spread it around out there. And there is the question of like, okay, then how do you make money? How do you actually make a living? And I was looking at, we were talking earlier about mail art, collage art, and these sorts of things, and I think that there needs to be again more collaboration. Where I find it very interesting that nobody talks about the artists that make the actual package when they talk about artists selling their work or, musicians selling their work.
Right.
And I think that there might be something in that in terms of doing collaborations between visual and recording artists to create packages that are, products to sell in order to generate income, an income stream, as an example of an idea.
Right. I'd like to learn more about packaging myself.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked online and seen different CD sleeves that you can get.
Yeah.
There are some pretty elaborate packages.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you have to buy 1,000 of them at a time.
Right, right.
Something like that.
Well, and this comes around to, like how to, be creative.
Yeah.
Because, at this point, there's different ways you can go. You can get a CD pressed. But in order to get a pressed CD, there's various hoops to jump through, not to mention the cost factor.
There's the mastering, which is pretty expensive.
Yeah, yeah. But then the other side of that is to do CDRs, which are dirt cheap and readily accessible.
If you buy them in bulk, you can get them for 30 cents a piece.
Oh, you
or
can
less.
Less. You can get them. Here in town, you can get it for 10 cents a piece.
Ten. Where?
That's where. It's Benchmark. I was getting them for 10 cents a piece there. I think it was 10 cents a piece.
It's got to be more than that.
It's pretty cheap.
It is pretty cheap, but it's not that cheap.
Because I know that the it's that cheap. Okay, we've had confirmation. Right. Okay.
250?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it's $25, right? 25 cents?
Yeah.
Times 100? Oh. Sorry, we got strange sounds going on in the background. It's
that's
breaking!
That's the medium is the message.
Oh, at half speed.
16% slowed down.
Oh, okay, it goes down to 16. Wow. so at any rate, coming back to the idea of being able to put together sort of saleable product in order to generate, part of this comes around to my sense that one of the things that I see organizations like SOCAN and other things trying to do is to monetize everything. And monetize things that actually, first of all, don't cost anything, and don't actually generate any kind of currency in relation to money anyway, which is, i.e., sharing things online or, you know. And I personally feel that digital is offering us a gift in terms of, you know, there's no cost, pretty much, to getting things out there and sharing them around on there.
Well, there's the initial cost of the computer. There's the what you pay for your internet service provider.
Yeah.
But it can be infinitely reproduced.
Exactly.
With no loss of quality.
With no exactly. And I see it as in terms of ideas, right? When you share an idea, you don't lose the idea.
Right.
You still have it. You can, you know, give it to someone else, and you can still have it. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful that way. So in that sense, I'm very, very skeptical about monetizing digital streams. I think that it's actually quite dangerous in that it gets back to the scarcity model. I think that that's, you know, the underpinning of consumerism in general sense is, you know, create a scarcity and then charge people for it.
Right.
And I think that that's part of the thing with trying to monetize the online exchange is in order to create that scarcity. Artificially create that scarcity. So, like I say, I mean, I'm very much trying to look at angles where, as an artist, of course, I want to make a living. But also, as an artist, I don't want to put artificial barriers that are going to limit me.
Right.
Which is, I think, what that sort of stuff does.
I heard a really alarming interview on CBC. This was some years ago, and I can't remember the artist.
Yeah.
But he did get he was approached by a major gallery.
Yeah.
A major dealer who said, you know, wanted to deal his stuff.
Right.
And he sat down with the artist, opened up a bottle of scotch.
Yeah.
And said, "Well, who do you want to sell your art to?
Right.
Where do you want to sell your art?"
Right.
Said, "Well, I suppose where it'll do me the most good."
Right.
So the dealer phones up one of his one of his regular customers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was British royalty.
Oh, yeah.
A duke or something.
Mm-hmm.
And said, "Well, I've got something that would complement your portfolio quite nicely."
Right.
And I wonder if he maybe just did that to show off.
Right.
Show the artist just what a big what shot he
connected.
Is.
I'm connected, baby.
But to get into that position where you are being sold.
Yeah.
For one thing, a major dealer, the commission is enormous.
Yeah.
They can charge up to 80% commission for, like, a top-notch gallery.
Right, right.
But also, the dealer went through the artist portfolio.
Yeah.
And said, "This is good, this is good, this is crap.
Right.
I can sell this. Don't make any more of these."
Right. Oh, yeah, that's part of that lowest common denominator thing we were talking about.
And it's more richest common denominator.
Yeah, in that sense, it's true.
But it's a lot of the same restrictions that they put on rock bands when they sign with a label.
Yes. Yeah. No, and that is, I think part of it where, as an example with, Nine Inch Nails, where, I think it was last fall, where he released, was it 4 or 6 part? Anyway, this multi-part instrumental album that I think had 6 different parts to it called Ghosts. And all over the place.
Right.
I mean, and the thing was, is it was after he left the label, right? Once he was out on his own, he was able to actually do, you know, this, you know, elaborate, extensive kind of expression that, you know, he would never have been given that kind of latitude within the label structure.
Well, I'm sure that there are plenty of tapes in the vaults of record labels.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, things come out every once in a while.
Yeah.
you know, an artist is gets some renewed attention.
Yeah.
And so, and maybe they're dead.
Right.
But they bring out something that was never released before.
Right.
But you know, at the time, the artist worked on it.
Yeah.
Obviously, and the record company owned it.
Yeah.
And they chose not to release it.
That's right.
And the artist had no choice in the matter.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Who really owns it? Well, and that's, I saw an interview with Natch the Slash in the late 90s where he was talking about how he was going through and releasing his back catalog because he actually retained ownership of his stuff.
Smart, yeah.
Whereas most of the people that he was doing that stuff back in the 70s, I mean, he was a part of the cutting edge of electronic music, and there was a lot of other bands that were doing it at the same time, but they didn't retain their rights. And so there's not enough interest, quote unquote, for the labels to release that stuff or re-release the stuff. So they're stuck. They can't do anything. Whereas,
right,
you know,
if they want to re-release their own material, they have to pay for that privilege.
That's right. Yeah. And even if they pay, it's like not necessarily, you know, it's, they have to, you know, court the label, you know, where it's like, or whoever owns the stuff.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, you know, who is this stuff really for? I think it really does come around to you, like I said, about creating a scarcity. That's something that I think we need to challenge at every front, which, like I was saying before, about why I'm such an advocate of open source software as an example of how innovation does happen without a direct financial incentive, which is comes around to the big reason, quote unquote, for copyright, patent, and all these sorts of things is apparently, according to certain reasoning, that's the only way that people will actually make stuff or innovate.
Simply not true.
I know.
A lot of programs, very powerful open source programs, started because somebody was making a tool for themselves.
That's right.
And they offered it free. They offered the source code to anyone who wanted it.
Yep.
And anyone who found it useful would start to add their own features.
That's right.
Because it was completely open.
Yeah.
And then by starting this project and releasing it, you get back a better version than the one you made.
Exactly. You know, and in point of fact, there are incredibly successful commercial companies that make money from open source software. Red Hat being an example, where they sell their Enterprise Edition, where all of the source code is still available. You can, you know, but you're buying support, this whole, you know, kind of complete package around it.
Right.
Now with Red Hat, they know that by working with the communities involved in all of this open source software, they're getting a way better product that they can then offer than any closed source applications, because they have literally millions of people around the world developing their software. But, you know, they don't try to lock it down. They don't try to close it off. They don't try to create an artificial scarcity. What they actually offer is added value, right? That's what they're actually selling.
And well worth it, then.
And well worth it. And part of it is, like, many, many years ago, a friend of mine bought the full package for SUSE, which is one of the flavors of Linux. And it came with a full set of CDs, a book, you know, and the option to buy a full commercial support plan. And so it's a matter of, you know, not trying to restrict things that don't need to be restricted, but rather offering something that has value that takes it further, right? So,
Well, we can't take it any further
today.
We are running out of time.
Ticking down. Yep.
If you want to queue up a station break, I'll see if Parker's ready to take over the next hour.
Okay. Now, which one down here? Oh, there it is. Winamp. And we will bring up a little station break. But that's been our show for today. Meanwhile, let me just kind of clear up this. Holy, somebody was listening to whack of stuff. And, oh, I see Parker coming in behind me. Oh, where's the delete button on?